This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Gene Randall. The coronavirus pandemic continues its relentless and cruel way around the world, with 1.7 million cases and a death toll moving toward 105,000. The figures come from Johns Hopkins University. There is a sad break with tradition this Easter weekend, as millions of Christians will spend the holiest day of their religious year away from churches, their extended families, and friends. The same is true for Jews who are celebrating Passover, all because of COVID-19 and the deadly threat it poses. In the Vatican, St. Peter's Square remains eerily quiet. Yesterday, Pope Francis led a small Good Friday procession, held away from the Roman Colosseum for the first time since 1964. The event marks the final hours in the life of Jesus. There will be a similar scene of enforced tranquility in the Holy City all through a weekend that normally draws huge crowds of believers from around the world. Here in the U.S., the number of coronavirus cases tops 503,000, with over 19,000 fatalities, now more than Italy. But there are some positive signs in the state of New York, where conditions in the epicenter, New York City, are easing. Daily death tolls in New York are still heavy. 783 have died since yesterday, but new infection rates have been falling and hospital admissions are down sharply. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo says a statewide lockdown is clearly helping to flatten the curve of the pandemic. Fewer beds than anticipated are being filled. The same is true for ventilators, and there's been a downward trend among intensive care unit patients. There have been more than 8,600 coronavirus deaths in the state, most of them in New York City. The neighboring state of New Jersey has suffered some 1,900 fatalities. The third worst hit state is Michigan, with 22,000 cases and a death count of close to 1,300. U.S. President Donald Trump is promising an early announcement on reopening the American economy. White House stay-at-home guidelines run out on April 30th, and Mr. Trump is widely thought to be intent on getting the country running again as early as May 1st. Via remote, this is VOA News. In Europe, the all-too-familiar story, Spain and Italy account for over 300,000 pandemic cases. Together, they've lost 35,000 lives. In France, the number of COVID-19 deaths is more than 13,000. Italy's nationwide lockdown has been extended through May 3rd. But the special commissioner for the pandemic, Domenico Arcuri, says, quote, "The virus has not been defeated, but we are on the right path." He also said a gradual reopening of the country would be complex and disciplined to avoid a second wave of contagion. European leaders this weekend are pleading with their people to avoid holiday excursions. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has added 2 weeks to his country's lockdown, the largest in the world, affecting 1.3 billion people. Johns Hopkins numbers for India, 7,600 cases with 249 fatalities. In Cyprus, leaders of the Greek and Turkish sides of the island say because of the pandemic, they're renewing a pledge of cooperation with a focus on health aid. Greek Cyprus is internationally recognized, while Turks occupy the northern half of the island in contravention of international law. Cyprus has reported 595 virus cases with 10 deaths between the two sides. There's been a major increase in coronavirus deaths in Britain, almost 900, bringing its new total to just under 10,000. The UK has had almost 74,000 cases. Health Secretary Matt Hancock says while hospital admissions are leveling off, it is too early to say if the country's infection numbers have peaked. He says there is a need for more evidence. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Boris Johnson continues his COVID-19 recovery after being diagnosed 2 weeks ago. He is still hospitalized in London, but is said to be spending some time out of bed and doing some walking. South Korea is moving to implement a controversial plan to put wristbands on people who refuse to self-quarantine as a way to monitor their whereabouts. South Korea's numbers, 10,450 cases and 208 deaths. Africa continues to be spared the full wrath of the coronavirus, with Nigeria, the most populous country on the continent, reporting only about 300 confirmed cases and 5 deaths. South Africa reports 2,000 infections with 24 fatalities. Morocco has suffered 110 deaths among 1,500 cases. Egypt's numbers, 1,800 confirmed cases and 135 lives lost. U.S. President Donald Trump says he's agreed to help Mexico with global oil output reductions. The surprise move could help break the impasse over a major round of cutbacks by oil-producing nations aimed at stabilizing crude oil prices. Mexican President Andres Manuel López Obrador said earlier in the day that the U.S. cuts would amount to 250,000 barrels a day, but Mr. Trump said details were still being worked out. More news online at voanews.com. There is also a convenient, easy-to-use mobile app. This is VOA News by remote. I'm Gene Randall.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
Government doesn't have what it takes. No equipment and no qualified personnel. You are talking of a country of 200 million people or above. And where did the government of the day, including various state governments, showcase the testing of citizens?
A major Nigerian civil society group says efforts by the government to curb the spread of the coronavirus are not impressive.
It's taking advantage of the coronavirus to crack down the opposition militants, getting them arrested, torturing them. It shows how much this president, this government, don't care about the Guinean people and their life. But I know for sure, at the end of the day, we will prevail.
Guinean opposition parties and civil society organizations say they will not accept the country's new constitution.
Testing is inadequate, and that means that government does not have the kind of data that they need to make very serious decisions about people's lives and people's livelihoods.
And the South African main opposition party warns that the extension of the lockdown will create an economic disaster. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Nigeria, the International Society for Civil Liberties and the Rule of Law says it is displeased with the performance of the government to curb the spread of the coronavirus. The civil society group says the administration appeared ill-prepared to handle cases of the disease. The group's remarks come after Boss Mustafa, head of the Presidential Task Force team on COVID-19, said until he was appointed to lead the team to fight the disease, he did not know the country's health infrastructure is in poor shape. To learn more about the concerns of the civil society group, I reach Emeka Omiegbalasi, leader of the International Society for Civil Liberties and the Rule of Law in Nigeria.
It is so far so terrible, so to speak. It is a whole lot of disappointment, a huge one at that. It is nothing short of government effort. It's nothing short of cover-ups and fire brigade approach. So it is so disappointing, and it is nothing to write home about.
But Emeka, the government has demonstrated to all Nigerians that it has implemented measures, including palliative measures and distributing of money and food items to the less privileged in society as part of the effort to ensure that citizens stay at home to curb the spread of the COVID virus. Isn't this enough?
Like I said before, those so-called government measures or palliative measures and what have you are nothing to write home about. The truth of the matter is that the government of the day was never prepared to govern Nigeria. And the same government was not prepared to manage this coronavirus. The government was in scatacle the moment as a result of the eruption of coronavirus. So no effort. A situation where 99.5% of Nigerians are complaining, the poor Nigerians are complaining, are dying of hunger, are suffering, some of them trying to break off from the restriction of movement so as to go and fend for themselves to find something to eat. So nothing like that. There is the realities on the ground are entirely different in opposite direction to the government claims.
Boss Mustafa, who is in charge of the Presidential Task Force on COVID-19 and the leadership of the National Assembly in Abuja, on Thursday said, until the outbreak of the coronavirus, he was not aware that the health sector was in a bad state. Some are suggesting that his admission is a first step to trying to resolve some of the issues associated with the fight against the COVID-19 or the coronavirus disease. What is your reaction to that?
Well, it goes on to confirm our position. Our position is that government of the day, nothing is working in this country. There is no functional system in the country. The social services, including healthcare facilities, are in comatose. The energy is in chronic crisis. The critical infrastructures are not in place. The data system is dead. So it's a confirmation. We are happy that the Secretary to the Government of Federation, had to make that a public admission of the comatose notion of Nigerian health system, not only health system, but every other thing. So I don't think that there is something that can be done on this issue right now, because it doesn't take 24 hours or 1 month to fix all the decayed infrastructures, particularly the healthcare system.
Emeka, critics of your organization, the Inter-Society, have asked what your organization is doing in your way to help the government in the fight to stop the spread of the disease. And what have you been able to do so far? And how are you engaging the government or sensitizing the people of Nigeria to help curb the spread of the disease?
By this program and others we have done, I think we are helping the government by offering constructive criticism, by identifying those areas that government has done well and those areas that government have not done well. For instance, if you look at the coronavirus management in Nigeria, we divided it into two. The areas government can do has something to offer, and the areas government doesn't have something to offer based on the realities on the ground. So government, for instance, has the capacity to fumigate, has capacity to engage in house-to-house distribution of protective devices and food items and, of course, cash. And also government has the capacity to enforce restriction of movement, provided it is done with human face in realization of consciousness of the rights of the citizens.
The government has come up with some figures about confirmed official cases of the disease, COVID-19, or the coronavirus. What is your take on it? Because I understand your organization seemed doubtful of the government official figures.
Yes, very correct question. Yes, we disputed and still dispute government figure. To the fact that as at yesterday, that 288 Nigerians were found to have contacted the disease. I now question, is it what looks like random sampling? Because obviously government doesn't have what it takes. No equipment, no qualified personnel. You are talking of a country of 200 million people or above. And where did the government of the day, including various state government, showcase the testing of citizens? If you go to isolation centers designated both at federal and state level, they are empty because nobody has been tested. Government does have the capacity. So the issue of telling the whole world that the Nigerian infection figure is 288 is dismissive and doubtful. As a matter of fact, and from independent perspective, the number of people living with that particular scourge is likely to be in tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, correctly speaking. So that is the position. So we challenge and dismiss and doubt the government figure. It's unrealistic and it's untenable.
Emeka Omiegbalasi is the leader of the International Society for Civil Liberties and the Rule of Law in Nigeria. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Opponents say they will not accept the new Guinean constitution. They argue that it was not approved by a majority of the population, adding that it is illegal and an affront to the country's young democracy. Meanwhile, civil society and opposition groups are calling for an independent investigation into violence against demonstrators before the referendum. They accuse security agencies, including the police, of carrying out the violence which left dozens dead and many injured. Their remarks come after President Alpha Conde enacted the new constitution this week. Attorney Thieno Sulemani Balde is a member of the opposition National Front for the Defense of the Constitution and president of the Board of Research Institute on Democracy and Rule of Law. He tells me that as soon as the issues with the coronavirus are resolved, opponents of the administration will launch a series of nationwide actions to show that the new constitution will not be accepted by a majority of Guineans.
This is what we have asking for a long time, because we have seen other than the killings of innocent citizens. Now they are using the torture to oblige people to recognize some of the killings while everyone knows it's false. In order to have truth, we need to have an independent investigation which will take into account the current situation and make a credible investigation that can help all of us to get through this and to know exactly what has happened. It will help the victims. It will help the rule of law to be established in Guinea. And I think it's in the interest of everyone.
Supporters of the president have rejected the calls for an international independent inquiry, saying the security operatives were simply enforcing the law and that the victims got what they deserved because they were asked to peacefully protest, but they didn't. They clashed with security operatives. They dismissed the call, saying that civil society groups and opposition groups, including you, are trying to call on the international community to influence the internal political situation in Guinea, which they said is unpatriotic. What is your reaction to that?
You know, this is not a surprise. So far, we have more than 150 young Guineans who has been killed for nothing. And in all of those killings, we have filed several complaints, but none of them so far has been subject to any kind of investigation. The latest killings, even the chief of the investigation of the police said specifically that the lady Issa Yero Jallo was killed by one gendarme. Instead, they have arrested around 10 young Guineans, tortured them, wanting those young Guineans to admit they have killed the lady. Right now, they are in jail. The government doesn't want the Guineans and the international community to know exactly what they are doing. So they won't upset any kind of independent investigation. We know that, but we have to keep pressure on the government because we need to know the truth. We need to know exactly who are killing Guineans and why the government refused to organize a free and fair investigation that will know all of us to know the truth. So we have to make pressure on the government to let that investigation put in place in order to have the truth.
Supporters of the ruling party have questioned the existence of your group that says you are defending the constitution. They asked, what constitution are you defending since there's a new constitution? So they said your group is irrelevant. What is your reaction to that?
Look, the constitution that they are talking about, we will never recognize it. And it doesn't have the legitimacy and also the legality to be enforced. They were saying that the May 2010 constitution didn't get the support and the agreement of the Guinean people. While this is what they are calling a constitution, we all know how their elections were organized. Even 10% of the Guineans didn't vote for that constitution. The majority of Guineans are opposed. If we upset that constitution, the right of the Guineans that we have been fighting for decades, that so many people have given their life, will be useless. So they can't say whatever they want, but we still and we will keep fighting for the May 2010 constitution to be applied. Whatever cost, we will have to pay for that.
I hear opposition and civil society groups, opponents of the new constitution, are saying the government will not be able to govern effectively because they will continue to oppose it. What does that mean? And what recourse do you have, particularly when the new constitution has come into being, which will enable President Alpha Conde to seek additional terms in office?
You know, from the beginning, the agenda of the president is to how to manage to be once again a candidate for the 2020 presidential elections. The 2010 constitution doesn't allow him to do more than two terms. So all of his agenda and his struggle is how to pass that obstacle. And now he's pretending that he has a new constitution and he can be a candidate. But, you know, as I told you previously, the majority of the Guineans are opposed to that idea. And right now, it's calm for one simple reason. We have the coronavirus and we care about the Guinean life, so we cannot organize mass demonstration. In his side, despite the fact that everywhere around the world, people are focusing how to fight against this disease, he is taking advantage of the coronavirus to crack down the opposition militant, getting them arrested, torturing them. It shows how much this president, this government, don't care about the Guinean people and their life. But I know for sure, at the end of the day, will prevail.
Attorney Fiano Sulemani Balde is a member of the Opposition National Front for the Defense of the Constitution and president of the Board of Research Institute on Democracy and Rule of Law. He spoke with me from the Guinean capital, Conakry. South Africa's main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, or DA, is warning that President Cyril Ramaphosa's extension of the lockdown until the end of this month will create an economic disaster. The lockdown, officials say, forms part of the effort to curb the spread of the coronavirus. South Africa officially has 1,934 confirmed cases of the disease, with 18 deaths. Jordan Lewis, a spokesperson for the opposition party, tells me that the government lacks empirical data to prove that the lockdown is helping to curb the spread of the disease.
We've said that if the lockdown is to continue, there needs to be some sensible and safe relaxations for industries and for workers who can earn a little bit of money during this time very safely without risking infection. Because the economic cost of 100% full lockdown is so devastating for many, many poor workers and small business owners who simply cannot survive this time. So if there's a way that we can have a safe lockdown, and we believe there is a way, have a safe lockdown and allow some workers to safely return to work and to begin very small reopening of the economy, then we think that that will be very beneficial and will help us get through this without a humanitarian crisis of starvation and mass unemployment.
Jordan, supporters of the government argue that there's ample evidence that the lockdown is helping save lives, and there's empirical evidence that it is effective, and that is why they applaud the president's decision to extend it. What do you say to that?
There's actually a lack of empirical data about the infection rate in South Africa altogether. We know that there is very low testing compared to other countries. We've only tested 70,000 people in total. Some other countries are testing that number per day. And so it's very difficult to make informed decisions without adequate testing. Now, when we started this lockdown more than 2 weeks ago, we were told that there would be a rollout of mass testing that has still not taken place. We hear it will start this week, but we're not certain. So it's very difficult to make informed decisions without proper data. And the fact is that the government has not delivered the data that they said they would. And so it's a very, very tough choice to make without that data.
Well, Jordan, why is the Democratic Alliance of the view that it is a great mistake to think in terms of lives versus livelihood when South Africa, together with other countries, are locking down to try to prevent the spread of the coronavirus? Some people are saying you are only thinking, or your party is only thinking about business while the government is focused on saving lives.
The choice between lives and livelihoods is a false dilemma. They are both deeply interrelated, and I'll explain why. The government needs to spend tens of billions of rands on the health response to the coronavirus at precisely the same time that there is a complete collapse in tax revenues. Think also about the thousands of small business owners and the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people that they employ who are out of work with no income whatsoever for more than a month, you know, at the end of this nearly 6 weeks. And you see that actually there is a very strong link between lives and livelihoods. It's not one or the other. It is always both. So what we are saying is that we can have a smart lockdown. You achieve the flattening of the curve and you achieve health, public health safety, and you also allow some small openings of the economy that allow some money to flow and some income to flow, particularly to those most vulnerable workers who are just receiving absolutely no income at the moment.
Is it the Democratic Alliance's view that the measures implemented by the government, stringent measures, if I may, have been ineffective so far?
That new view needs to be formed by the data. And I'm afraid we do not have the data because the testing rollout has been so slow and so limited. As I said, we've only tested 70,000 people in the whole country, a country of 60 million people. There are many countries testing that number of people every single day. So the testing is inadequate, and that means that government does not have the kind of data that they need to make very serious decisions about people's lives and people's livelihoods.
Moving forward, what do you think are the best steps forward for the government to take to achieve what the Democratic Alliance's views about this lockdown and the fight against the spread of the coronavirus?
We've advocated for a smart lockdown approach where the government can reduce restrictions or increase restrictions based on the data that comes each week. That requires a massive wide-scale testing program and screening program, and it requires the government being willing to have an approach that is informed by data and which is not a blunt instrument, ham-fisted total lockdown, which is what they have at the moment.
Jordan Lewis is a spokesperson for South Africa's main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, or DA. He spoke with me from the capital, Pretoria. When the coronavirus began hitting Western economies, it hurt the economies of African countries too, not only because of a loss in trade and tourism, but also due to a loss in remittances. Hundreds of thousands of African families depend on money sent home by relatives working in North America, Europe, and elsewhere. The safety net for millions of people is now threatened, and some families fear for the worst. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Fatuma Salah is a Somali national living at the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya. The mother of six says she closely monitors any message that comes to her phone. Salah says, each time I receive a message alert, I think it is a money transfer to my account, but it is not. She says, I was expecting to receive money from my family. It is the 10th day of the month. I haven't received anything yet. Salah depends on her mother and brother who live in the United States, but both have lost their jobs and stay indoors due to the COVID-19 pandemic. In 2018, Africa received $82 billion in remittances from abroad, according to the Washington-based Brookings Institution. Remittances amount to 5% of GDP in at least 13 African countries. For some, like tiny Lesotho, they amount to 23% of its annual income. With stay-at-home orders throwing millions out of work in Western countries, millions of Africans are feeling the pinch. Adiu Achuel is a South Sudanese student studying in Kenya. She's afraid she might end up homeless, just like her neighbors.
If it continues for more than 2 to 3 months, I don't even know what is going to happen, not only to me, but to the people that I know are staying in Nairobi and being supported by some of their relatives or their husbands in the USA. And at the moment, we have people who are staying at public schools since they cannot afford to pay rent.
Speaking via messaging app, Abdirashid Duale, the head of the Habshil, one of Somalia's biggest money transfer services, says his company has seen a reduction in the number of people sending money to Africa.
We have seen less money going to Africa, but of course, the current crisis that impacted the community we serve, we're very sorry. A lot of people in diaspora have got this virus. A lot of families are not helping the way they used to help. These remittances rely on very poor people, whether they're refugee camps or whether they are paying the school fee or they're paying the food.
Duale, whose company operates in at least 40 countries in Africa, calls on the financial institutions and governments to make sending and receiving money easy because it saves lives.
We would like international government, European government, UK government, UK financial institutions help so that the community have access to banking. The company like the Habshil has a full access to the commercial banks, so that the remittance that going to Africa will not be stopped, will continue to reach people safely.
The United Nations Economic Commission for Africa said last month Africa needs $100 billion to combat the virus and support its vulnerable citizens and economies. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Botswana's main opposition party, the Umbrella for Democratic Change, says it is against the government request that Parliament approve a six-month state of emergency. The request, officials say, will help the administration fight the spread of the coronavirus. The request comes as neighboring countries, including South Africa, takes various measures to combat the virus. Meanwhile, Botswana remains under a three-week state of emergency due to the disease. Moeti Mohwasa, spokesperson for the opposition Umbrella for Democratic Change, tells me that the additional time requested by the government is unconstitutional.
As we are aware, the Botswana parliament is dominated by the ruling Botswana Democratic Party, which won the last elections under very controversial circumstances. The UDC, which is the main opposition party, objected to the introduction of the granting of emergency powers to the president, because our argument is that we cannot centralize power in one person. Our take is that the existing pieces of legislation are adequate to take care of whatever the government needs to address the corona pandemic. But what we also argued is that we can actually improve the other pieces of legislation rather than give him sweeping powers.
The government is of the view that a declaration of six-month state of emergency will accord sufficient time to allow the marshalling of what is needed to succeed in the fight against the coronavirus. Why do you think this is not necessary from the government?
We should understand that Botswana is a democratic party, and there is a reason why we opted for this democratic dispensation, which means that all the three arms of government should work at full capacity. The current state of emergency does not give those arms of government full powers, and the powers now rest on the president. What we are saying is that absolute power on its own is not adequate to be given to one person. Our position is that the current pieces of legislation are adequate enough to deal with the current situation. What we could probably have acceded to is a situation where they're asking for an amendment of the current piece of legislation to give the Director of Medical Services enough power to deal with the current situation. Our position was that the government or the president should have been given 28 days, which is consistent with the current lockdown, after which we'll assess the situation. If need be, then the president could actually, in terms of the power given to him by the Constitution, issue a proclamation for 21 days of a state of emergency.
But Moeti, people are arguing that the COVID-19 or the coronavirus currently that a country faces is unprecedented, and that unprecedented measures would have to be taken in order to contain the spread, since the disease is deadly and unlike what most people have ever encountered before. So extraordinary measures are needed by the government, and for that matter, the president, in order to take action to protect life and property, particularly when it's mandated under the Constitution for him to protect life and property as a core mandate. What do you say to that?
We should understand that here in Botswana, we are a parliamentary democracy. It doesn't mean that the president on his own has the sole wisdom or has the monopoly of wisdom to deal with this pandemic on his own. We need all hands on deck. And our position is that concentrating power in one person will not assist. In fact, as the UDC, we fully support the efforts that the government or health officials have introduced, and we encourage everybody to support the health officials in terms of all the efforts that have been made to contain this disease, because this is a deadly disease. But what we are against is the introduction of the state of public emergency. That is where we are differing with the government. And we are saying we should actually be strengthening the current pieces of legislation rather than go for the Public Emergency Act. We have said to the president, if he can go with the current 28 days, and after 20 days, 88 days, we feel there's need to give him more powers, we will gladly do so as the UDC. If he needs more resources, we will gladly do so. But we are against the situation where he goes for 6 months. That is too much, we believe, and does not protect the civil liberties of our people. And above all, whatever we do as a nation, we should make sure that there are checks and balances, like I emphasized earlier on. And having put aside all this, the functions of all these other important arms of government, does not help in terms of ensuring that there is accountability.
With the dominance of the ruling party in parliament, does that mean you don't have any more pushback that you can raise in parliament, particularly when you are strongly opposed to the request the government is seeking from parliament about the six-month state of emergency?
Unfortunately, we have no recourse. I mean, this is more like tyranny of the majority. I mean, even when you are supposed to go for debates, like it has happened in the past, what they will do is you will have one person, one MP arising from the BDP side and say, let's go for a vote. And that's the unfortunate thing. You know, that culture of debate, that culture of engagement, of being accommodative, is actually dying in this country. And we wish the situation could be different.
Moeti Mwasa is the spokesperson for the Botswana Opposition Party, the Umbrella for Democratic Change. He spoke with me from the capital, Habaroni. A Zimbabwean woman is suing authorities to force an end to the national lockdown after she was allegedly bitten by officers' dogs during curfew enforcement. President Emmerson Mnangagwa has urged discipline and unity during the lockdown to curtail the spread of the coronavirus. But rights groups say there are growing concerns over abuses committed by security forces during the ongoing 21-day lockdown. For VOA Colombo's Mavunga reports from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights is petitioning the High Court to have the coronavirus lockdown overturned after police allegedly unleashed a dog on a woman for violating curfew. Court papers submitted by the lawyers group say police and army officers assaulted 26-year-old Lucia Masondo while she was cooking food in her yard. The lawsuit argues the lockdown regulations violate Zimbabwe's constitution and should be annulled. Kumbirai Mafunda is with the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights. He says Masondo's case is one of a growing number of abuses by security forces during the lockdown.
She suffered some wounds after some enforcement agents set a dog upon her when she was preparing a meal outside her house in Karoi. In Blabayo, our lawyers are intervening in a case in which there was someone who was reportedly assaulted by the police and died.
Zimbabwe police refused any immediate comment on Mashondo's alleged assault, but acknowledged they are investigating it. Zimbabwe rights groups say they have recorded more than 100 cases of security forces abusing civilians, including detentions of journalists, since the lockdown began 2 weeks ago. Zimbabwe authorities say the tough measures, which require people to stay in their homes except when buying food and other essentials, are necessary to prevent more coronavirus victims. Zimbabwe has recorded 11 cases of COVID-19 so far and 3 deaths. In an Easter message broadcast Thursday on Zimbabwe's state-owned television, President Emmerson Mnangagwa said the lockdown would not ease during the holiday weekend.
I'm aware that in the past, the Easter holiday season would see most families, friends, as well as worshippers gather together. Sadly, this will not be possible this holiday as we continue to observe the essential lockdown to prevent the spread of the deadly COVID-19 pandemic.
Mnangagwa said security forces would intensify patrols to curb the movement of pedestrians and vehicles. He urged the public to be patient and responsible, saying the answer to the crisis lies in their discipline and unity. But critics say the government has failed to create social safety nets for many Zimbabweans who depend on street vending to make a living. The Southern African country's economy and healthcare system are in tatters after years of mismanagement and poor investment. The World Food Programme says more than half of Zimbabwe's population needs food aid. That will tempt many out of their homes despite the risk of coronavirus or running afoul with security forces. Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights hope to put an end to the restrictions through Masondo's lawsuit. The group expects to know the hearing date for the case early next week. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Saturday marks the one-year anniversary of the overthrow of former Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir after 3 decades in power. But 12 months after the revolution, many Sudanese are wondering whether their demands of freedom, peace and justice have been met. VOA's Jason Patekin reports.
Huria Salam wa Adala, Arabic for freedom, peace, and justice. That was the rallying cry of Sudan's revolution, which 1 year ago today succeeded in overthrowing dictator Omar al-Bashir after 30 years of military rule. But 12 months on, many Sudanese question whether those 3 goals have been achieved. Regarding freedom, before the revolution, Sudan was regularly considered one of the most unfree countries on earth. Journalists and activists were routinely harassed, locked up, and even assaulted. Heba Morgan, a Sudanese journalist in Khartoum, told VOA that she enjoys more liberties now than when Bashir was in power.
There's not a lot of harassments like there used to be in the past. You don't see journalists being beaten up. You don't see media houses being shut down for an article they posted. However, the remnants of the old regime are there. So you still, there's some kind of constraints in terms of wanting to travel from Khartoum to anywhere. Recently, I've been to Kassala, and you have to report to the security organs. You have to make sure that the military is involved. You can't do anything without them.
The revolution also promised more freedoms for women. Revolutionaries considered women protesters to be Kandaka, or Nubian queens, and women often led the protests against Bashir. But Morgan, who reports for the Qatar-based Al Jazeera network, says that gender equality espoused during the revolution has not come to pass since.
The same attitude that I felt working more than a year ago before Bashir was ousted is the same attitude that I get from people out in the streets now. I mean, just the other day I was stopped by a police officer who was basically like, I don't like what you're wearing. And by all standards, what I was wearing, I would say was pretty decent. Otherwise, I wouldn't be going out working in it.
Peace and justice likewise remain elusive. Despite months of negotiations, Sudan's government, which largely comprises elites from the region around the capital Khartoum, has yet to reach a peace deal with armed rebel groups in the rural Darfur, Nuba Mountains, and Blue Nile regions. And while Bashir now sits in prison on a corruption conviction, he has not faced justice for the greater crimes he is accused of. Bashir and his accomplices are wanted by the International Criminal Court on charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity. And many of Bashir's former military allies remain in power, sharing the country's leadership with a group of civilian representatives. Those former allies include Army General Abdel Fattah Burhan and Mohamed Hamdan Hemeti Dagalo, who leads the notorious Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, militia. Both men were commanders under Bashir in Darfur when atrocities took place. Mohamed Bagan is a lawyer in Darfur.
Unfortunately, political regime and political elite don't care about resolution in Darfur because military council representative Burhan and Hemeti don't like peace and freedom and justice. Why? Because Hemeti and Burhan committed crime in Darfur.
I'm not satisfied. This is a revolution. Why?
Darfur state, for example, don't have peace, don't have shelter, don't have security, don't have education, don't have road, don't have really representative and make a decision.
don't change any situation in Darfur.
Magdi Al-Jazuli, a Sudanese analyst from the Nairobi-based Rift Valley Institute, says still, Sudan today is in a far different place compared to before Bashir's overthrow.
There are expectations from a broad section of the population that want to see something different. But of course, what you shouldn't forget, these are the problems of the morning after. The army and the RSF, they don't have the free hand that they had in the Bashir. They definitely don't. They can't do whatever. They can try, but they don't have a carte blanche. They need to argue their way through. They need to offer explanations. Now the role of the army is debated. This wasn't possible before 2019. The fact that these things are in the air make it a different situation.
Al-Jazuli says one of the main challenges is that civilian leaders have yet to come up with a political program that can effectively challenge the powerful military.
They say we reject the government's proposals, but in place of these proposals, there's no obvious program. That's the challenging moment today, is that will the mass movement be able to produce a political language or a political narrative? A new political order has not been born yet.
As Sudanese citizens continue their struggle for freedom, peace, and justice, it seems their revolution is far from over. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Washington.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Baby, dance, dance, baby, shake, shake, yeah.
You I'm to choose, girl, I choose you. If I'm to lose, girl, I want to lose with you. They say that taboo, but girl, I see truth in you. You. She was calling for me. Do you really care? Show me what for me, baby. Show me in the town. To be sincere, I will do almost anything for you. Anything for you.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the chameleon changes its color to match the earth. The earth doesn't change colors to match the chameleon. I'm your host, Peter Clontaine, Washington. Good evening, Africa.